Part 7 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on intention with Jack Kornfield.
Along with the states that are either contracted or open in this psychology, there are a series of neutral qualities that one can observe, functions of mind. Recognition, kind of memory, is one of those neutral qualities. And another quite central one is the quality of jetana, which means will or the will to do. And intention is directly associated with this quality. It is a neutral quality in that this capacity to choose or direct our energy or will can be directed toward that which is skillful and brings happiness and ease and opening and wisdom, or to that which is unskillful and creates conflict, suffering, and difficulty. The very first verse of the Dhammapada, the verses of the Buddha, begins, "Mind is the forerunner of all things." Begins with mind. "Speak and act with an impure mind or heart, and sorrow will follow you as surely as the wheel follows the oxen who draws the cart." Mind is the forerunner of all things. Speak and act with a pure heart and mind, and happiness will follow you unshakably as closely as your shadow. So there's a tremendous power to the mind, this non-physical aspect of our being, to envision, to create, to destroy. Power individually to direct our lives, and collectively, cities, whole civilizations arise and pass due to the power of mind. The city of San Francisco, you know, you drive over the Golden Gate Bridge, and when it's not foggy on those days, when you can see it there, this huge kind of conglomeration of shapes and buildings and towers and streets and so forth, they were all imagined by someone. Oh, let's put a street there. How about a building shaped like a pyramid? Put it over there. First it was an image, and then the material form followed that image that created it. And it's the same thing that will, in the cycles of life, bring cities and civilizations to their end, which happens, just in case you'd forgotten that fact, right? So mind is this incredibly creative energy. Visualize, imagine, create, and then also destroy. Annie Dillard writes about a Eskimo hunter in the Inuit tribes who had been part of the old ways, and a missionary moved in, a priest. And this priest was giving the Eskimo the teachings of what will happen, heavens and hells and all those kinds of things. And finally the Eskimo looked at the priest and said, "If I didn't know about God and sin, would I go to hell?" And the priest said, "Well, no, actually, not if you didn't know." "Then why," asked the Eskimo, "did you tell me?" We won't follow that thread very much further, but it is also true that many of the sorrows that are immediately around us, tribalism, warfare, racism, again, are the product of the vision that we bring to other human beings out of our mind. Now, I'll tell you some stories tonight that many of you have heard before. They're kind of parts of the central myth of Buddhism. And one of the things that both took some getting used to and it later on became very reassuring, like bedtime stories that you've heard over and over again, in the monasteries where I trained in Asia is that I would hear the same stories over and over from the masters where I studied, and I kind of got to appreciate the stories as I heard them and kind of work with them each time. So the story of the Buddha, it is said again in this myth that Siddhartha Gautama, the sage of the Sakyas, born in India 2,500 years ago, was much, much longer ago, a long, long time ago, when you were all much younger than you are now, was born in India, a whole world system ago. And at that time, there was a Buddha who lived on the earth named Dipankara Buddha. And Dipankara Buddha, who was the expression and action and word and energy of radiance and freedom and compassion and joy, was wandering through a kingdom in India and was invited by a particular town to come and visit. And to prepare for him the path through the woods, they took the textiles and the things that they'd woven and they placed them on the road so that his feet, to honor him, his feet should have these beautiful textiles to walk on. Everybody took their turn, but there was one young man who was supposed to help who didn't get it together in time, and there was this radiant Buddha walking along, and there was a kind of a muddy patch. So without anything to place there, he threw his own body down on the earth. And as he did, he looked up at the presence of this being, the Dipankara Buddha, and was so taken with this possibility, with the graciousness and peace and compassion from the eyes of this Buddha, and said, whatever it takes, this is so beautiful to experience, whatever it takes in this world, I too will become such a Buddha. And he took that vow, and as Dipankara Buddha stepped over his body in the path, he said out loud, yes, I have heard this vow and it is true, you too will manifest as a Buddha in this world. Kind of affirmed it. Then it took him a while, as you heard in the stories, to cultivate the perfections of patience and wisdom and truthfulness and virtue and steadiness and determination and compassion and loving kindness. It's said that he practiced for 4 immensities and 100,000 mahakalpas. The mahakalpa is the image, if you have a mountain that is a yojana high, the distance an ox cart can go in a day, which means as high as Mount Everest, and 7 miles wide and 7 miles long. Every 100 years, a bird with a silk scarf in its beak comes along and drags the scarf along the edge of the mountain, wearing it away slightly. When that mountain is worn down by the bird, that's one mahakalpa. So it took the Buddha a while of practice. But his intention was there to fulfill this. And in a way, when you hear such a story, what becomes obvious is that this is not talking about time as we know it. This is really talking about the archetypal realm and that which is timeless. But this intention, in whatever circumstance or realm happens, to cultivate or meet that with patience, with loving kindness, with steadiness, with compassion. And in due season, the fruit ripened and fell to the earth, as it does, as a Buddha. Now, traditionally, Buddhist psychology and teachings is filled with accounts and instructions for the power of directing one's intention. Every time there's a meditation or a gathering of people together, at the end there is a traditional sharing of merit, which means a saying out loud that whatever benefit may come from making ourselves more present, more peaceful, more harmonious among one another, more free and compassionate in our hearts, may this benefit be spread out to all beings that live. May we share this with all beings. It's also kind of a good deal, you should know this just on the side, that it's said that if you give away all your merit, may I give away all the good deeds and all the good karma of my life, that kind of intention, it doubles it. So so it works in your favor as well as the favor of all other beings. Just so you know that, just an aside. So at the end of every meditation, may this be of benefit to all beings is the intention. At the beginning, when one starts practice, there are recitations. May this be of benefit for myself, for my family, loved ones, community, and on, setting the intention of the heart in practice. Now, it's true our society as well knows about this power of intention, and it's used all the time, primarily in the service of advertising, isn't it? You need this. Set your mind on this, and you can get it. Or consumerism, you know, or money, or politics, and so forth. And it's repeated, and they know if you repeat it over and over, then it starts to have a sort of life or force in people's minds. What did you have in school today? A father asked his teenage son. Oh, we had lectures on sex, the boy replied. Lectures on sex? Well, what did they tell you? Well, first there was a priest who told us why we shouldn't. Then a doctor told us how we shouldn't. And finally the principal gave us a talk on where we shouldn't. So when things are repeated and we engage in that repetition, it starts to create interest, energy, visioning, form. Now in the early tales of the Buddhist teachings, they come in animal stories. When the Buddha spoke of past lives, he used to tell these ancient Indian tales of animals. One is a tale of the forest fire. And this one little parrot who was able to fly away but terribly concerned for his friends on the ground, and so began to dip himself in the river and find a little rabbit or mouse and dive down in the fire and shake a few drops of water and try to save the animals and put out the forest fire. As the story was told, after some time, the gods in heaven looked down, and the seat of one of the gods, the chief god, gets hot, it said, begins to heat up when anything unusual happens on earth. So he looked down and he said, what is this silly bird doing thinking he can put out a whole forest fire? Became interested in this, and out of interest turned into a great eagle and flew down and flew alongside this little parrot and said, what are you doing? The parrot said, I'm trying to help my friends. There's this big fire. The eagle said, but you're a little bird, you know, you can't put out a fire. The little parrot said, you know, at a time like this, I don't need advice, thank you. If you want to help, that's cool. Otherwise, you know, fly off or whatever. And dipped himself in the river and got more, and came over and went back and forth, singeing his own wings. And so the eagle decided to help a little bit and mostly watched in amazement at this bird flying through the flames. And then watched as he would dive down to his friends, the mice, the rabbits, the badgers, the animals of the forest. And he saw such a love from this little bird toward the other creatures that his heart broke open as an eagle and he began to weep. And of course you know what happens when the gods begin to weep. And all of a sudden, there was a great thunderstorm and clouds opened up and the tears of the eagle of compassion for this bird and the animals turned into rain and put out the whole fire. The forest was cool and the animals were free. And the eagle bid his adieu to this parrot and she thanked the eagle. And the story is told in children's language because that place in us, even that's a child, the child in us knows the truth of this as well as any other part of us. The truth of the power of our heart and our intention. Now in the story of the Buddha, to continue, as you all know, the story has it that when the Buddha was born in India, he grew up and lived in the palaces of his father, summer and winter palace, surrounded by luxury, and because his father wanted to keep him in the palace to be a king, he never saw anything that was painful or difficult. He was shielded from that. And yet at some point, this innocent young man said, I must go out and see the countryside. Went out with his charioteer, and the countryside was cleaned up. But even though it was cleaned up, he saw what were called the four heavenly messengers that appeared, as they do to each of us when we move from that place of innocence to into the world. And the first, as he was out looking at the sights of the world, he saw a very old person, 90, 100 years old, tottered, broken teeth, scanty hair, blotched limbs. This is the description in the sutras. Hardly able to hear and see. And he looked at the charioteer. He had never seen someone that old. He said, who does that happen to? What is that? Oh, it's an old man. Who does that happen to? Everyone, if you're lucky. Gave the Buddha some pause for thought there. Went along further in this journey. And he saw a person very, very ill who was lying in their own filth, cleaned up by others, fed food unable to eat, emaciated from it, trembling. And he said, who is it that gets sick like that? He'd never seen someone so sick. The charioteer said, most everyone. Further cause for reflection. Then he went further in his journeys, saw the countryside, and at some point saw by the side of the road the corpse of a man who had been lying there for a day. I don't know if you've ever seen the body as one does in Asia, in the charnel grounds, that's just been out before it's burned, but just take some meat out of your refrigerator and put it out in the sun and see what happens in short order to it. Same happens to a human body. And it was bloated, and remember the first time you saw a corpse, a dead body? It's really indelible. It touches very deeply. And the Buddha said to the charioteer, to whom does this happen? And the charioteer said, everyone, no one is exempt. Death is certain. The only thing that's uncertain is when. And finally, the fourth of the heavenly messengers, as the Buddha was out, he saw a man with a shaved head and robes, a yogi. And he said, who is this? And the charioteer said, this is a being who has gone out from the complexities of his life to live simply in the forest and seek a salvation, seek a freedom in the face of birth and death, of what you've just seen. And after seeing this, the Buddha, it's as if he remembered that old part of himself that had taken the vow to awaken. And again, he retook that vow. I too will leave the beauties of the palace, all the things I have. I must find this secret of freedom. Now, it's not just ancient that this happens. In the forest monastery of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, we would go out on alms round in the morning. And when Ajahn Chah first came to the West, came to our center in Massachusetts, but he brought with him a couple of Western monks, a good friend, Ajahn Sumedho, who was an American monk, to establish a small monastery in England, which has now grown quite large. And when they got to England, they were invited to this little house in London, the English Sangha Trust. And Ajahn Chah said to the monks, he said, you must go out every day on alms round. And they said, but this is a weird thing to do in this country, barefoot with a begging bowl. No one will know what we're doing. And he said, no, you must do it because it is part of your practice as a monk to go. Even if people don't put food in, kids would stop and say, what are you? And they'd explain. Sometimes they'd throw in a little of their lunch or, you know, sometimes nothing. But they would go out every day. Now, it turned out there were two very good reasons for going out. The first, when they asked the teacher further, why is it that we go out? We hardly get any food. People think it's strange. And Ajahn Chah looked at them and he said, you must go out because you are a messenger. And it's possible, you don't know, but it's just possible that someone walking along the streets of London will see you and is the next Buddha. So you go out not just for yourself, but you go out as the messenger to tell the world that there's another way. So they went out every day, and one day Ajahn Sumedho, after some months, was walking through one of the parks in London, and a man came jogging by doing his morning jog and stopped and said, "What are you?" He said, "Well, I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm a forest monk from the forests of Thailand." Man said, "Well, where do you live?" He said, "Well, actually, I live in an apartment down the road because that's all that we have to live, and we monks take whatever is given." And the man talked to him a little bit, and he said, "Well, you know, I have this beautiful forest, and I wondered who would take care of it. Could I offer it to you?" And so, I don't know how many acres, 400 or 500 acres of land in the most beautiful and valuable part of England. He wrote a little note and put it in the monk's bowl. "Here, I give you a forest," which became the first big forest monastery in England. So the day in the monastery is devoted in part to the strengthening of this quality of intention. You get up at 3:30 in the morning and start with chanting and meditation and sitting and walking. And in doing it, you begin with chants, "Namo Tatsa Bhagavato, Iti Piso Bhagavara Hang Samma Samputo," where you chant to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And the chants are a praise to see the beauty of the Buddha nature that is there to be seen in every being, to awaken that. "This day, may that awaken in me and all beings." A chant of the homage to the Tao, the Dharma, the eternal truth or law. Then you dedicate your day. "May this day be a benefit to all beings." And then you do a chant about your body, hair, skin, teeth, liver, blood, pus, urine. You kind of name all the parts of the body, and then you, as part of this chant, there's a kind of inquiry. Is this yours to possess? And is this who you are, really? So there's a reflection. Who am I? And then you do a chant of a reminder of old age and sickness and death. And after all these chants, then there's a dedication. During this day, through sitting and walking, words and deeds, may I come to experience the freedom of heart of a Buddha and the great compassion of a Buddha. May I bring that to all beings. Thich Nhat Hanh likes to teach these intentions for lay people as short poems or gathas. You know, driving your car, you say this little poem as you get in the car. The car goes fast and so do I. You know, kind of remembering that the two of you are together. May I helps. May I drive in such a way that brings harmony and blessings as I travel to all beings. Taking a cup of tea, the intention to nurture oneself and the world. Alms Round was really such a beautiful thing, one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, to go out early in the morning when the sun comes up, because you can't thank people, you do it just in silence. Sometimes very poor people wait and give of the little food they have. And all you can do is take that silently, respectfully, and inwardly say, if these people so love the spirit of the Dharma, so love the truth and the spirit of renunciation and compassion and awakening that the monks represent to them, to give their little bit of food, all I can do is take that and dedicate my own life to fulfill that. Oh, very strong energy from those offerings. Because here we are richer, each one of us, even the poorest in this room, much richer in many ways materially than a lot of those villagers. So this is the power of intention. Intention creates what will happen. From the Buddhist teachings, thought leads to deeds. Deeds become habits. Habits harden into character. Character shapes our world. So watch the ways of your thoughts with care and see that they spring out of love for all beings. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross likes to talk in her hospice work about how people die in character. How you live is generally how you end up dying. And I know this month, 1 year ago, was the time that I spent with my father as he died. It was just been 1 year. And because he had lived with a great deal of fear and paranoia, that was what was there for him as he died. I could try to reassure him and hold his hand and be with him, which helped some. But the patterns are very, very strong in us. What you practice over and over is what becomes. So this friend who went to study with the Tibetans in the 1960s and was kind of wondering about Tibetan Buddhism, but was taken by the simplicity and the warmth and the humor and the love of the Tibetans, who had lost everything of outer circumstances that we would value, their land, their country, their status, their wealth, all of those things. And yet the Tibetans remain, for the most part, incredibly joyful and gracious and generous people. And he went to meet this teacher who became his teacher, Khandra Rinpoche. He said, "I remember one rainy day, the rain was dripping through the roof, and Khandra Rinpoche had opened his large multicolored umbrella inside to protect the few books that he had saved as he carried them out from Tibet. And he was laughing under this umbrella, this great laughter wiping out every hesitation and doubt and all the silly thoughts rising in my mind. I thought, if he can laugh in the midst of this, this is something I want to learn." So what we practice becomes what we bring into life. And what happens to us. At the time of death, the elements change and the body becomes heavy and sallow, and the earth element, you become stiff and then rigid, and sometimes it feels like there's rocks on you or mountains on you. And the fire element, you can experience heat or as if you're in a fire, and the wind element, the psychic winds come up. It's not very easy to go through that kind of process and stay true to your heart, to your intention. You know the book, many of you probably read a long time ago, about the last one of the native Californian Indians, about Ishi in two worlds. Well, one of the most extraordinary stories about Ishi is that in his particular tribe, he had told the anthropologist that he was working with many of the teachings and chants and songs of the tribe, but there was one that was particularly secret, that was never to be given to anyone outside the members of that tribe. But right before he died, he taught it to the anthropologist, to the people that were working with him, because he had to, because he was the last of his tribe. Even though he was teaching this secret chant to the culture, the people that had been the cause of the destruction of all of his people. And the song that he taught was the song that has to be sung after a tribe member dies, to sing them to the land where the others who have gone before them will greet them. And so it was necessary to teach this last secret song so that when he died, he could be sung to the place of the ancestors. What songs do we sing in our minds, and where will they take us? Spiritual life, in this practice we do of attention and compassion, the purpose is to train us to bring our hearts and minds fully to this life. So the Buddha sat down under the Bodhi tree, as you do each time you sit, to awaken, only he made perhaps a slightly stronger intention than you do. He sat down and said, "I will not get up from this seat until I have completely come to the center of this question of freedom in life, until I have come to absolute freedom. I will not get up." And all these difficulties came until he finally ask the goddess of the earth herself to bear witness to his patience and truthfulness and dedication and compassion, life after life, to bear witness to the fact that he and we have a right to sit on this earth and to awaken. And then, in the watches of that night, first he saw, as his mind cleared, all the past lives, thousands of them, his life. And then, as the night grew on, he looked and saw the karmic patterns of beings everywhere, being born in different forms, following the intention of their thoughts and hearts and deeds, again and again. And then finally, in the midst of that, he came to the untangling or freedom to see that it is possible to let go of this body of fear, of grasping and attachment and identification, and to become absolutely free and selfless in the midst of it all, to rest in universal peace and compassion, which he called nirvana. And that's there any time we open to it. When you awaken in any moment, what you discover is that what you looked for, what you sought, what we long for to be free, was always here. It's nowhere else. We just didn't know. Now, it's interesting for most of the people that I know, unlike perhaps the story of the Buddha, is that it doesn't just happen once, but there is this reawakening again and again. One Zen master called it enlightenment after enlightenment, one after another. You know, or another said, today's Satori is tomorrow's mistake. That is, you have this moment of awakening, but you can't hold on to it again the next moment. In Tibetan practice of dream yoga, as you do the meditation, happens in Vipassana as well, when we, especially in longer retreats, number of weeks or the 3-month retreat we teach each year, after a while, for many people, the mind becomes very still and so present that as you lie down to sleep, your dreams become lucid and you become aware of the whole process of sleep and dreaming. But it can also be cultivated. There are Western techniques for lucid dreaming. Tibetan dream yoga is done when someone has mastered some basic meditation skills of concentration and calm. Usually it's taught during a 3-year retreat, after a year or two of practice. Then the dream yoga begins by setting the intention, this evening when I lie down to sleep, may I be as clear and lucid in falling asleep and dreaming as I am in meditation now. And that intention is repeated over and over and over and over again for a number of days, a couple weeks. And at some point, by the power of that intention, combined with the steadiness that's been cultivated in mind, most people then begin to experience that sleep becomes just like another meditation. The power of intention. In deep meditation, it's wonderful to work with. When concentration is ripe, when you are very still and the mind becomes malleable and pure and not distracted by thoughts and fears, when you've let go of those, then you can use the power of intention for all different kinds of states. When the mind is very pure, you can sit and say, may rapture arise. Just say the word to yourself and your body becomes filled with bliss. Just happens. Wonderful. May I be filled with light, and it just happens like that. Or may I enter a state of absolute stillness. Different kinds of states you can set your intention on, and because the mind is so directed and steady and pure, it happens. It's wonderful to do. And whatever things that you've enjoyed playing with, you know, if you like skiing, you know, or you like movies, or whatever it happens to be, this kind of play is fantastic. It really is. And in the same way, when the mind is very well trained and skilled and deep in steadiness, you can direct it to all kinds of understandings. May I see the arising of consciousness? And you notice how consciousness plays with the senses through that intention. Or may I see the state of consciousness that shows the dissolution of life and death and that will appear to you. All these things. So intention is a very powerful thing. Now, it's important also to understand that it has certain limits. There are certain things which no yogi, no angel, no God, no being in the universe can control or bring about. What things are these? That what is subject to old age should not grow old. That what is subject to sickness should not be sick, or death should not die. That it was subject to decay or pass away should not pass away. And others such as that. And the Buddha goes on. He says, suppose that a person comes along with a huge flaming torch and says, I will light the Ganges River on fire. Will it do them any good? Or they come with a shovel and a bucket and say, I will dig up this earth. I am tired of this earth and I will dig it up. Will that do them any good? In the same way, you can say, I won't grow old. Good luck. Right? Or I won't die. Or things won't change. So the way we need to understand the limits of intention is that intention works when it is tuned with the truth of reality. Can an apple seed create a mango? It doesn't. You plant an apple seed, it makes an apple tree. And when you plant it, you can water and fertilize and give it proper conditions, and then a beautiful apple tree grows. In the same way with the quality of intention, we awaken our own Buddha nature. We manifest what is perfectly possible for every human being, which is to be a Buddha. Just like the most beautiful rose doesn't try to be a sunflower or a columbine, although they're beautiful too, it is in itself a rose. So the intention for us that is most central is to fulfill our own true nature. There are vows that are taken in Mahayana Buddhism, the Zen vow. Zen practice starts over and over again with the four vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. The dharmas are inexhaustible. I vow to master them all. Desires and attachments are endless. I vow to put an end to them all. Those kind of vows. But does that mean that we are going to do that? We're going to save every other being? That would be kind of messianic and perhaps slightly overly grand, don't you think? Shantideva says, even when I have done things for the sake of others, no sense of amazement or conceit arises. It is just like having fed myself. I hope for nothing in return, because there's nothing apart from myself. So the vows one takes, Hui Nung writes about these vows. He says, I vow to save all sentient beings, to master all the Buddhist teachings. Learned audience, all of us have declared we will deliver an infinite number of beings. But what does that mean? Does it mean I, Zen Master Hui Nung, am going to deliver these beings? And who are they, these sentient beings? They are the delusive mind, the deceitful mind, the mind of greed and attachment and such like. Each of them must deliver itself by means of its own wisdom or essence of mind. So it's not that some intention that we're going to do to someone else, but it's really the intention that we will awaken together. In that, there's a kind of a grace that comes when we set our heart to awaken. It brings an energy into our life and all of life. In the life of a monk or a nun, which we take now as lay people to awaken, there is forgiveness practice, the practice of virtue, reminding oneself in speech and deed today to not harm other beings, to be truthful. There's the rededication daily of one's merit and of one's heart, the forms of reminders. Because you don't just make your intention once, you know. 7 centuries ago, 7 white doves rose from a deep valley flying to a snow-white summit of the mountain. One of the men who watched that flight said, "I see a black spot on the wing of the 7th dove." Today, the people in that valley tell of 7 black doves that flew to the summit of that snowy mountain. You can't just do it once. You actually do it again and again and again. And you begin to feel the possibility that comes from the power of the heart when you repeat the intention or the dedication in your life. And it's really beautiful. There's a story again. During World War II, a Norwegian priest was called in by the local Gestapo for interrogation because he knew about underground activity and things. And he was brought into the Gestapo headquarters, and the lights were turned on, and the Gestapo officer sat down, and he was sat in this metal chair, and then the officer reached in his waistband and put his Luger, his pistol, on the table before conducting the interview. And the priest sat there for a moment, and he reached in his satchel and he pulled out his Bible and he thumped it on the table next to the gun. And the Gestapo officer said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you took out your weapon and put it on the table, so I've taken out mine." There is an incredible potential for freedom in the human heart, an incredible possibility that leads us not away from the world, but to find that perfect compassion in a moment of love, that perfect sense of freedom in the midst, no matter what happens to us. Zen Master Dogen: "A fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there's no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there's no end to the sky. Now, if a bird or fish tries to reach the end of its element, this bird or fish will not find its place. When you find your place where you are, then awakening occurs, actualizing the fundamental point, the truth. For the place, the way, is neither large nor small, neither yours nor others. It is not carried from the past, and it is not arising now. The way of the practice of the Buddha is to meet one simple thing, this moment. And being in this moment, one practices completely." There's a certain danger in talking about this quality of intention from Buddhist psychology and traditions. And that is that it can get confused, either that, oh, you use it for parking spaces, you know, which is not what it's about. As I said, it has to be in harmony with the law of nature. Or intention gets confused with effort or will or trying to make something happen. And in the end, there is really only one intention or effort in spiritual practice, and that is the intention to open or to awaken, to be with what is true in this life. May I be present, awake, free in heart and mind. In that sense, may I remember who I am. That Hindu song, "The child in the womb, may I not forget who I am." And then as soon as it's born, "Oh dear, I've begun to forget already." The taboo against knowing who we are is Alan Watts' phrase for it. So we pretend to sleep. May I remember today who I really am. Who were you before you were born and after you die? Everyone knows that the drop merges into the ocean. Few people know that the ocean merges into the drop. In the end, what you discover is that what we seek, what we long for, is who we are, most truly who we are. And so this intention to awaken, to remember, gives joy, tremendous strength, malleability, patience, all those things, not because you even cultivate them over 100,000 mahakalpas, but because they're your birthright, your true nature. Martin Luther King, I still believe that standing up for the truth is the greatest thing in the world. This is the end of life. The end of life is not to be happy. The end of life is not to achieve pleasure and avoid pain, which you can't do anyway, is it? The end of life is to do the will of God, to act with truth, come what may. And on Gandhi's tomb, if you go in India to where Gandhi's body was burned in the Ghats along the Ganges outside of Delhi, there's this great green lawn and a big stone wall. Very, very peaceful place. And carved in the stone wall is one saying from Gandhi: before you act, before each act of your life, before you act, think of the poorest person that you have met and ask yourself, will this act be of any benefit to them? This was the intention of Gandhi's life. And that intention had so much truth and love and care to it that it transformed millions and millions and millions of people. You might study or work with intention. You might study, for example, the intention that's there when you speak with others. And simply notice without judgment, is the intention to learn, or the intention to get something, or the intention to protect yourself, or the intention to be helpful, or to listen? Without any judgment, just notice what the intention is in a particular conversation, and then see what comes from the conversation based on that intention. It's a very simple place to study this quality of jetana, or intention.
This concludes part 7 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Please turn the tape over for part 8.